Republicans on Capitol Hill have produced a plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. Barely 2 days since its big reveal, there's harsh criticism coming from conservative groups and fellow Republican lawmakers who think it doesn't go far enough to replace Obamacare, to which House Speaker Paul Ryan said with confidence at a press conference Tuesday,
"We will have 218 votes. This is the beginning of the legislative process. We've got a few weeks. We'll have 218 when this thing comes to the floor. I can guarantee you that. Yeah."
Hi, I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for Kathleen Dunn. House Republicans are urging Americans to get up to speed on this 123-page plan. Note the hashtag, read the bill. Joining us now to work through the details is Mary Agnes Carey of Kaiser Health News. She's covered health reform and federal health policy for more than 15 years as an editor at CQ Healthbeat, as Capitol Hill Bureau Chief for Congressional Quarterly, and at Dow Jones Newswires. Mary Agnes, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
House Speaker Paul Ryan, as you heard there, very confident that the House will get enough votes to win passage of this plan. This plan is yet very young, and there seems to be quite a bit of discontent about it from fellow Republicans, from outside conservative groups and Democrats. Can you give us an overview of the areas where lawmakers are pushing back on this plan?
Sure. Some of the conservatives dislike the way that the Republican bill would allow advanceable, refundable tax credits. These are tax credits that people could use to purchase health insurance. They have them also under the Affordable Care Act. The Republicans do it differently, wouldn't spend as much money, but nonetheless, conservatives are saying you're creating an entitlement by saying that people can get these tax credits on a refundable, advanceable manner. So that's one concern about it. Outside groups are also concerned about some of the structures. Conservatives and some outside conservatives on Capitol Hill and some conservative groups outside of Capitol Hill are very concerned that the law really doesn't have that clean, full repeal of the Affordable Care Act like they wanted. There are some things in the law that are kept. There are some that would be removed. Some would be replaced. So as you noted, there's a lot of pressure, counter-pressures within the Republican Party and the outside conservative groups that say, why can't we just have a clean repeal? We finally run the joint. You know, Republicans run the House, they run the Senate, we've got the White House. Let's have a repeal bill and then do a replacement bill. That's not the manner in which it seems to be proceeding. Democrats also have a lot of concerns about the bill, as do some outside patient groups and provider groups. They feel the subsidy structure won't be generous enough, that especially low-income people will be worse off with this subsidy structure. They also disagree with the shift in the Medicaid program to remove it from the current structure where the federal government matches what states spend by various formulas, but there's no cap. This would shift, the Republican proposal would create a capped allotment. They're calling it the per capita cap, but a set amount. And beyond that, states would not get more money. So you've definitely got concerns on the right, concerns on the left. Right now, there are two markups ongoing on Capitol Hill. A markup is where a committee considers the piece of legislation and usually takes amendments. But so far, in these committees of jurisdiction, Democrats aren't getting the chance to offer any amendments, so you're having a lot of tension. I just came back from the Hill, and at the Energy and Commerce Committee, the Democrats, as they could do, asked for the entire bill to be read aloud. So these poor staffers are sitting there reading chapter and verse out loud of the bill, but this is the strong pushback the Democrats are getting, in particular because as of about 1:30 this afternoon, they were getting no option to amend the bill.
You've just come back from Capitol Hill. What is the mood like, the tenor like on Capitol Hill? What are people saying around you in the halls as we hear this play out?
We're going to be here for a long time tonight. This is really going to be a tough process. There is a lot of, it's kind of fascinating, the charges and the counter charges about how many committee hearings did the Democrats have when they passed the Affordable Care Act in 2009 and 2010 rather is when it was passed, but all the discussion surrounding it in 2009 and 2010. When did the Democrats have One thing that's heavily sought in this is the Congressional Budget Office, which is the nonpartisan scorekeeper for Capitol Hill. They have got to come out at and pronounce for the Republican proposal how many people would it cover, how much money would it save, how would individuals fare, this kind of thing. They call it the CBO score, again, CBO for Congressional Budget Office. There's lots of fighting on the dais between the Democrats and the Republicans about how the Democrats handled the CBO numbers, and Republicans are saying, basically, we didn't do anything that you didn't do when you passed the Affordable Care Act. It's a lot of bickering. I mean, it is kind of a really intense environment, and you knew it would be that way because Republicans and Democrats have been fighting over this law for 7 years. And so now it's showtime for the Republicans. This is their alternative. They're putting it up there. And but it is not without severe partisan wrangling. And it's just kind of a microcosm of sort of the bitter partisan tensions we have on the Hill these days.
We're talking with Mary Agnes Carey. She's a reporter with Kaiser Health News. She's covering the repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act, the new legislation coming out of the House. It was published to the website apparently late Monday night. We got a very good look at it, the legislative plan, 123 pages of it yesterday, and now committees in session marking it up. Mary Agnes, analysis by Standard & Poor's estimates that between 6 million and 10 million Americans could lose their health coverage under this House plan. Who are the most vulnerable under this plan? Who are these millions of Americans?
Well, right now, under the current Affordable Care Act, beneficiaries, many of the beneficiaries of the subsidy, the tax credits to provide coverage, like two-thirds of them make $31,000 or less a year, right? They tend to get the most generous help. The way the Republican House plan would structure the subsidy credits is instead of basing them on income, as the Affordable Care Act does, these are based mostly on age. For example, if you are under 30, you could get up to $2,000 a year of a tax credit. That ranges up to $40,000 for people 60 and higher. And so that has become one of the big issues, that if you don't have tax credits based on income, and there is an income factor here, I should be clear, for the Republican plan, if you make, you're an individual and you make over $75,000 a year, or you're a couple and you make $150,000, at that point you start tapering down how much of a subsidy you get. But with the way it's designed with the Republican plan, again, we're looking mostly at age, slightly at income. The current Affordable Care Act is really geared more to income. The less you make, the more of a credit you get. And the subsidies under the current law also factor in your local area costs for health care. As we know, in some areas of the country, there's a lot of competition. It might cost less to go to the doctor or go to the hospital, cost less in the sense of the insurance company's coverage. In some places, it's more. Under the Affordable Care Act, the way that they determine the subsidies, they include those local factors for health care costs. That is not part of the calculation in the House Republican plan. So that's where you have people looking at it. And again, that's a key number we're all waiting for from the Congressional Budget Office. Who's left out? And how far will their dollars go when they buy coverage?
House Energy and Commerce Committee Chairman Greg Walden of Oregon, he briefed reporters yesterday, was one of the lawmakers in the briefings. He helped draft this legislation, and he asked for a thoughtful legislative discussion. Let's take a listen to his talking points of this draft plan.
Let me be clear. Our plan is the first step. Under our plan, we are moving forward in a positive direction to rescue the individual insurance market and give flexibility to our states. We are protecting those patients living with pre-existing conditions under our plan. We are not returning to the days of lifetime or annual limits. And we will continue to allow young adults to remain on their parents' policies until they reach the age of 26. And we will keep our promise to not pull the rug out from anyone, including those on Medicaid.
Mary Agnes, we keep hearing not pulling the rug out from under anyone, including those on Medicaid. Are we seeing this in this bill?
In the sense that there's transitional periods. For example, the shift in Medicaid funding wouldn't happen until January 1st, 2020. If you were someone who came into Medicaid coverage as part of the current law expansion on Medicaid, you would be kept in that expansion. The states would still get that. They get a little more money, considerably more money for you, rather, if you are in the expansion. That would continue as long as you stay in Medicaid. The shift to the subsidy, new subsidy structure, that also wouldn't happen until 2020. So in the sense of transitioning, not pulling the rug out from people, that is technically true. But what is interesting is when the chairman talks about this is the beginning of a conversation. Yesterday, even when the House conservatives were doing their press conferences and they were saying things along the lines of this bill, people are open to changes. You know, you kind of got the sense, I thought, we would be seeing a lot of amendments at the committee level today.
Yeah.
I wondered, frankly, if there might be amendments on the Republican side as well as Democratic side. And again, the tenor of the session that I was watching may have changed since I left there about 1:30 Eastern time. But it was pretty apparent, not only in Energy and Commerce, but in Ways and Means, that they were, the chairman were moving to get this thing passed. And one factor that could be at play here is there's general expectations that on the Senate floor, there may be more action on amendments. So one thought could be, let's just get it passed in the House. We know they're going to try to change it in the Senate, see what they do, and then it maybe it will come back to the House if there are modifications. I'm not quite sure where all of the if that's exactly what's in the Republican leadership's calculations, but it's fairly interesting to see that, you know, in hour three, hour four of these markups, there had been no consideration of amendments.
And the speed this is happening, of course, this has been a long time coming, repeal and replace. We've been hearing about it for a while, but now when the bill comes before Americans, comes before fellow lawmakers and journalists and budget offices, it seems it's become warp speed to get the thing moving forward.
That's not necessarily unusual, and I'm not speaking here in specific terms about the history, how the ACA went through, but I'm just telling you as someone who's been on Capitol Hill now for more than 20 years, that typically once leadership on either side decides this is our approach, this is what we want to do, they want to move as quickly as they can to lock it down. You know, they provided, the bill was dropped, as you mentioned, Monday night. It went online at 6 o'clock. The markup started today, Wednesday at 10:30, so people had more than 24 hours to review. And Paul Ryan, you know, you just had him, a clip from his news conference yesterday. He's having another one tomorrow. Leaders are very focused on moving this as quickly as possible because that's often how you get things done quickly. And if people are concerned, you try to remedy it fast, or you tell them later on in the process, maybe when it comes back from the Senate, then we'll add things or whatever, however they want to structure it. That said, it is kind of, you're totally right, they're moving very quickly. It is kind of rapid fire, but you have to think about, for example, the appropriations process or when Congress is moving to raise the debt ceiling. Or I mean, there's sometimes things are done very, very quickly up there. And as I was listening today at the Energy and Commerce session, you did have Republican members of the committee talking about all the hearings they had on these various issues in the health care law. And they did have a lot of listening sessions, and they did have a lot of field hearings. But today was the first time for this bill, this compilation of all these ideas, to get the public airing. And I think that's why there's so much focus on it and so much attention, and that Democrats, and particularly Energy and Commerce, where I was, were so upset about not being able to offer amendments.
We're talking with Mary Agnes Carey about the plan House Republicans have put forth to replace the Affordable Care Act. They're calling it the American Health Care Act. President Trump threw his support behind the House legislation Tuesday, and this begins the administration's hard sell to lawmakers and the public. Have you read the plan? What's your reaction to it? Add your voice to this discussion at 800-486-8655. What concerns you? What are you pleased to see in this bill? And you can add your voice at 800-486-8655 or post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit, maybe hear from you on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Mary Agnes Carey of Kaiser Health News. She's our guide on the GOP plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. She's there on Capitol Hill reporting on the committee hearings today. President Trump said Tuesday the plan meets the principles on health care that he spelled out during his speech to Congress, namely that it will lower costs, expand choices, increase competition, and ensure access to care. And we're digging into what the plan spells out and what you think about it. Join in the discussion at 800-486-8655 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call now with Sarah in Milwaukee. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thank you. I heard that they were going to take away the Mental Health Parity Act in this new plan, and I was wondering if there's any truth to that.
I don't think that is correct. The mental health parity law is a separate law and was implemented separately. And in the current Affordable Care Act, the ACA, there is a mental health care is one of the essential health benefits. But here's the thing that might change. Those categories all stay, and the categories also include things like maternity care and preventive care and hospital care and this kind of thing. Right now, under the Affordable Care Act, you can buy a policy that covers 90% of that cost or 80% of that cost, 70 or 60%. It's called the actuarial value for the technical term. What's different in the Republican healthcare law is those values are all stripped out. There's no platinum plan or silver plan or gold plan or bronze plan. Those are all gone. And so while the categories remain, at the Department of Health and Human Services, through the regulatory process, Tom Price, who's the HHS secretary, can kind of use his power through regulations and issuing of regulations and so on that might allow plans to be less generous going forward than they have been so far in those particular things. Paul Ryan talked about this yesterday, this sort of three-pronged approach, the first being pass this bill, mm-hmm. right? The second being the secretary using regulatory power to make changes, and essential health benefits is one of those areas. And the third part of it would be a little more difficult because that's where they need 60 votes in the Senate versus 51 on the current package because of some arcane budget rules. But that third part would be doing things like passing the ability to sell health insurance across state lines or medical malpractice reform. Again, that's a heavier lift because Republicans only have 52 votes in the Senate, but that's the third part of the strategy. So to my knowledge, mental health parity is not repealed, and mental health and substance abuse coverage is in the law, but the breadth of it, if you will, may change. What plans are required to cover and how much you have to pay as a consumer, that could all be in flux.
Sarah, thank you so much for your call. Let's now go to Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question for your guest involves, I guess the first would be a comment that it seems to be at least a step forward because people on the right and the left are unhappy with the law. So if you can get both sides unhappy, there must be a good compromise somehow in this law. And my comment or my question is, a lot of the comments people have about it still go back to, why don't we do a single payer? Doesn't the U.S. have a single payer system already in place through the Veterans Administration? And that is how health care is done by the U.S. by a single payer. We don't seem to talk about that, and I was wondering what your guest would say about that. Thank you very much.
Sure. Well, thank you for that question. I mean, single payer is something that comes up. As you may know, the Affordable Care Act was really based on the private market system, and that was done consciously, intentionally, because they didn't want any disruption on the employer benefits. And the feeling has been, and I would say continues to be, that taking the VA model or the Medicare model and broadening it to everyone in the country and having that a government kind of run single payer system, there just isn't the political momentum behind it. You could debate it, pros and cons. Obviously, we've had some issues with the VA, some good, some bad, as the years have gone on. Medicare insures something like, you know, close to 50 million people or so, that there are big numbers of Americans in these programs. But even within the Medicare program, for example, when the Medicare drug benefit, Part D, that's all private companies competing for business. So I just don't think we're there on single payer, but I do hear what you're saying. I've heard this from a lot of people when I do interviews. People seem to think, would that just get rid of the insurance companies, or perhaps the actually insurance companies might still have some involvement in processing claims, but could we simplify things with a single payer? But I just don't think America's there.
Charlie, thank you so much for your question and your insights. 800-486-8655 is the number to call if you have a question in regards to the American Health Care Act that has been introduced by House Republicans late Monday. Join in the discussion. Mary Agnes, Paul Ryan told reporters yesterday that this repeal and replace plan is rescuing a dire situation in that the Affordable Care Act is falling apart very quickly. And let's hear a bit of that.
Let's not forget, Obamacare is collapsing. Obamacare isn't staying. If we did nothing, the law would collapse and leave everybody without affordable health care. We are doing an act of mercy by repealing this law and replacing it with patient-centered health care reforms that we as conservatives have been arguing for and fighting for years.
So is the Affordable Care Act imploding like he's saying here?
I think imploding may be an overstatement. You have pockets of where it's going very well, like California has a large share of the Affordable Care Act enrollment. Premium increases there have not been as high as they have been in other parts of the country. But that said, we have all read these reports and seen these stories about areas of the country where insurers have pulled out. Maybe there's one insurer left. Perhaps rates have definitely gone up some areas to quite an extreme. Overall, on average, in the federal exchanges for the second lowest cost silver plan, the rates had gone up for 2017, an average of 25%. But even within that average, you had some spikes at 50 or 60 in some areas. And then in some other areas of the country, they weren't as high as 25%. It's kind of a complicated mix, if you will, because some areas are more competitive than others. Some areas of the country have more of a mix of choices and of a patient mix, and it's more competitive where hospitals or other providers might lower their prices a bit more to be part of a particular plan. But if you don't have competition, the rates go higher. There are definitely problems with the Affordable Care Act. I don't think anybody can dispute that. And one thing analysts were saying was they had wondered, you know, the exchanges started in 2014. What they were seeing before enrollment for 2017, some of these price hikes, was this going to be a one-time thing? Mm. Was it going to be, would it have continued into 2018, 2019, 2020? Was it more of a result that they didn't get enough healthy people into the plans originally? Did they not get enough young people? It's a very complicated equation, but I think it's a bit unfair to say that the ACA is collapsing everywhere. That is not true. You've had definitely had problems. You've had some problems in some states, some rural areas, but then you've had, like we talked about, California, things are going pretty well. So there's a lot being said on each side, but when you kind of boil it down and look at what's happening on the ground, obviously some problems, some successes.
But too early to show clear trend lines on whether it would be in a dire situation. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Exactly. I mean, we now have a different, depending on what happens, we are going to have a different marketplace for 2018. So even comparing the ACA from 2018 to 2017 will be different. This bill may or may not become law. Insurers now have until, I believe, they changed it through regulation. I think they have until June to say whether or not they want to participate in the marketplace. You can imagine this uncertainty is not something insurers want to see. Right. So even the ongoing debate, perhaps even passage of the law, it may make some insurers feel better or worse about participating. I mean, the 2018 marketplace will be shaped by this whole debate, even though some of these things don't start until 2020.
Let's take another caller now, Marion in Madison. Hi, Marion.
Hello. I have a comment that nowhere in this bill is there any mention of controlling drug costs or controlling the costs of medical devices. If you don't control those costs, you're not going to keep health care affordable. And as a prime example, the drug naloxone, which has been used for overdoses, That drug, I'm a nurse, that drug has been around over 35 years. It should be generic, it should be cheap, and yet the drug manufacturers are charging $650 to $3,000 a dose. That is ridiculous. And why is nothing being said about that?
Great point. You're right. Today, President Trump, and it was announced yesterday, met at the White House with a couple of Democratic lawmakers, and I think it was someone from Johns Hopkins here, to discuss drug prices. I mean, part of the reason is that the drug industry is incredibly well represented, you know, in the Democratic and Republican parties. They spend a lot of money on campaigns. They make it. They talk a lot about the cost that it is to bring a drug to market. But you mentioned the opioid overdose drug that's been around for a while. We had a story on that very fact that you mentioned. Here it is, a generic. It should be cheaper. Some companies have increased that price, in part, I think, because of the opioid epidemic, and some have argued their delivery device requires that the price be increased. But the idea of conquering drug prices is something that is getting a lot of attention and a lot of discussion, but it has been an incredibly hard thing for Congress to get its arms around. That said, I thought it was really interesting that yesterday this announcement is made about this White House meeting today between these lawmakers and President Trump to talk about drug prices, just as a bill, as your caller mentioned, that doesn't have anything to do about controlling drug prices is getting marked up on Capitol Hill.
Mm. We're talking with Mary Agnes Carey of Kaiser Health News. She's our guide this hour on the replacement to the Affordable Care Act, what it means for millions and millions of Americans. Let's take another caller now. Let's go to Linda in Ashland. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I had a question about this new system. Is the Medicaid coverage going to be blanket throughout the United States, or is each state going to handle it differently? And if they are going to handle it differently, do you know how Wisconsin's going to handle this? And then I also wanted to know if, you know, can we switch providers at any time, or will specific times be assigned?
Are you talking to Medicaid?
Yes.
Switch. Okay. Good question. I am not familiar with the Wisconsin Medicaid program, so that I can't answer in particular. But if you look at the Medicaid program now, some states pay providers more than other states. And since the capped allotment for Medicaid would be based on 2016 spending, it would grow by a percentage of medical inflation and one percentage point, so it would increase over time. So sort of regional variations on spending would be built in to these caps, these distributions they're going to give. There's also a lot of talk about flexibility for governors and legislatures and how they administer the Medicaid program. That has not been spelled out. And probably would do so in regulations, and states can apply for waivers to the federal government to craft their own approaches. But the overall thought is the shift from the current payment system for Medicaid, where the feds, on a matching basis, which varies all over the country, there's no cap to that. There's no limits on it. It's entitlement. Moving this to a capped program would mean less money for the states, more cost shifts potentially to patients. Will you have fewer benefits covered? Will you have waiting lists? Will there be more out-of-pocket requirements on Medicaid beneficiaries? All these sorts of things are not yet defined. But this is, a lot of people talk about it. I understand why they do it. Looking at the insurance market, the exchanges, the subsidies, what's covered or so on in the exchanges. But this whole discussion over Medicaid is really one of the biggest pieces of this law. And it's going to get, I think, some pushback from Republican lawmakers. I know in the Senate we've already heard this from some Republicans about how will this affect my state? Will this be enough money for my state?
And because states also have very tight budget times, some states are also quite poor who have recently taken Medicaid expansion. So is it clear to us whether states will accept and embrace more of the burden of how to carry forward Medicaid in their own states?
Well, I think it depends on the political makeup, right? If you have a conservative state, if you have a governor and a legislature that wants to craft its own Medicaid program to do it differently, to kind of be freed from what they view are constraints of the federal government, they'll take less money for more flexibility. But I think a democratically controlled state, or a state perhaps no matter what the party, that feels that things are running well on Medicaid and can, they're not too worried about the federal rules, things are working well, they're probably not going to be happy with this shift. I mean, now you're talking about whatever you spend is matched on a percentage basis, depending on the state and the federal match rate. There's no limit. There's no cap. Now it's going to be capped. So you will have some states, to your point, that maybe they've had rising drug prices or they've tried to cover new technologies in their Medicaid programs. When you have a set amount of money, again, growing by medical inflation plus a percentage point, but when you have a set amount of money, you're going to have to make more choices, maybe tougher choices. And that is not going to be pleasing for some governors and legislatures.
Thank you, Linda, for your call. Let's now go to Cheryl in Verona. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First, I just have a comment about the suggestion that Obamacare was imploding. I believe that the Republicans, through their lack of participation, did what they could to sabotage it. And states like California that are doing well, the economist from MIT this morning said in the news that who helped craft the original legislation said that if every state had been was mandatory that they participate, then this would be a huge success right now. So that's my comment. And then my question is, I understand that there may be folks that currently are getting insurance, health insurance, that will no longer have that. When they do need medical care, who in the end pays the bill for that care?
Great question. There's a federal law called EMTALA that requires hospitals that take Medicare funding, if you come into an emergency room, that they have to stabilize you, okay? Now, this does not mean if you need chemotherapy you need 8 visits of chemotherapy that the rest of your treatment's covered because you come to the emergency room. They are stabilizing you at that moment. But when people don't have coverage, that is passed on through the system, which often creates higher costs for other people. This was one of the principles, if you will, behind the Affordable Care Act, that if you got more people covered, you'd have less uncompensated care. And that uncompensated charity care in hospitals has been decreasing with the Affordable Care Act in place. So that's a very good question. What happens, unless they change federal law, people will be going to the emergency rooms to get treatment. Now, one other thing I should say about the Republican plan is it would provide $100 billion over 10 years for states to use money to help provide care for low-income individuals, help meet some of the cost-sharing issues. The Affordable Care Act has cost-sharing subsidies to help people under 250% of poverty, that's about $30,000 a year, to help them meet all their out-of-pocket costs. You know, where the subsidies cover the premium, these would be out-of-pocket cost sharing. That goes away in the law. That goes away in the Republican proposal.
Yeah.
But it also includes this additional funding for states that can set up a high-risk pool, or they can help people get coverage who can't afford coverage. It gives some flexibility there as well.
We've been talking with Mary Agnes Carey of Kaiser Health News about the long-awaited replacement to the Affordable Care Act that was released by House Republicans this week. And Mary Agnes is on Capitol Hill. She's watching the Energy and Commerce Committee and the Ways and Means Committee as they pore over this plan today in committee meetings. We also know that these committees do not yet have any Congressional Budget Office analysis of how much the legislation would cost or how many people it would cover. After we come back from a short break, we'll continue with your questions about the American Health Care Act. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for Kathleen Dunn. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. First, we're picking up our conversation with Mary Agnes Carey of Kaiser Health News on the House legislation to replace the Affordable Care Act. It was published and online late Monday. Yesterday, lawmakers and journalists got their first thorough read of the plan, and House Republicans urged Americans to read the 123-page plan. And you can join in this discussion at 800-486-8655 or post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. And we have a comment now on Facebook. Brian on Facebook writes, how much of this plan was developed by the insurance companies? Is there anything we can glean about this, Mary Agnes?
That's a great question. I don't have an answer for you, but I would think that there is some concern. I think it was the chairperson of the Molina Health Insurance Plan, or maybe it was a top official of Molina, talking about some concerns that the Medicaid expansion, the money there might not be enough. I believe, if memory serves from prior congressional hearings, I've heard people from the insurance industry being very concerned that if the subsidies aren't generous enough, people can't get coverage. But conversely, some of the changes in the House Republican bill, if it became law, would give wide latitude for all sorts of plans to be sold that really couldn't be sold now because they might not be viewed as generous enough. And for if you can write your plan to kind of gear it to someone who doesn't need a lot of routine care and can handle a high deductible, that tends to be, not always, but could be maybe a younger person. You make the premium cheaper, you kind of gear it in that way. That might be beneficial to some insurers coming into the market. I mean, you have to look at health insurance in the individual market before the Affordable Care Act had a greater variance of plans. And many people, as we know, loved that health insurance and they couldn't keep it anymore because maybe the insurer dropped out. That's one thing. Sometimes they leave markets and they change markets all the time. But if more comprehensive plans were the only ones they could get because they had to meet the standards of the Affordable Care Act and they had to pay more money, they would very much welcome maybe a return to some of these more scaled-back plans. I talked to a lot of people who were very happy with their coverage before the Affordable Care Act became law, and I also have talked to a lot of people who couldn't get covered because of pre-existing medical conditions. So, the insurers definitely are a voice in this, but they also have been fans of the federal assistance to help people buy coverage because it makes people buy health insurance.
Let's take another call now. Dan in Eau Claire. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I think it's too early to really tell, it sounds like, exactly what's going to happen and who's going to be covered and how much everything's going to be. And I'm just curious why we're not approaching this from a totally different aspect of the cost of what medical facilities, doctors, and all of the things that we need, tests, drugs, x-rays, why aren't we addressing that and trying to lower that? Because that's going to keep going up at a huge amount. Insurance companies, even under the new plan, are going to eventually say, we can't cover this. Everything's way too high. I heard something earlier in the week about antitrust laws has something to do with not allowing those costs to be made lower. Could you please comment on that?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I think in the private market, you're already starting to see some of insurers saying, we're not going to pay for that, or we won't pay as much for that. I'll give you a personal an example. I had a physician that wanted to do a CT scan at his office. It would have been extremely convenient to do that. I got a call from my health insurance company at home that said, while your doctor is in our network, he is not a preferred provider for that particular procedure, right? Mm. But if I went to the lab, if I went to a imaging company that was on the second floor of the same building, my insurance company would cover the whole cost. Now, I've never had that before, and I went ahead and followed that protocol. My doctor even called me at home and said, you don't really need to do that. You should have it done here. It's more convenient for you. I went ahead and said, no, it's fine. They can ship the image to you via email. So I think, and we've probably all had this experience where you might get a prescription from your doctor who might particularly think this brand name drug is the best for you, and maybe there's no generic available or they want you to get a particular drug, you go to the pharmacy counter and they tell you how much that's going to cost out of your pocket because your insurance company has said we're not going to cover this or we'll only cover 50% of the cost, that they're trying to steer you into more cost-effective, cost-effective services, drugs, this kind of thing. Now,
Go ahead, Mary Agnes. I didn't mean to stop you.
Oh, no. One thing I was going to add is in the Affordable Care Act, which looks at least now like it remains in the House Republican plan, are certain provisions in the Medicare program, including an office that was created to try to test better payment mechanisms for Medicare. So the Affordable Care Act has been trying to reduce hospital readmissions, for example, and bundle payments and do some other things. Some of those might stay, some of those might go, but what Dan is talking about is happening probably in the private market a little more rapidly than is happening in Medicare. Medicaid has had managed care for a long time that tries to control all these kind of costs. So this conversation is happening, with insurers and providers, and they both have probably different views of the same conversation. But I think we are getting more realistic about some of our services, some of our costs. There are always exceptions. The nurse who was on before that talked about the drug for the opioid overdoses, she makes a great point of a drug maker jacking up a generic that's been around for a long time. So it's one of these complicated conversations that continues to evolve, but more patient awareness is critical. I mean, when I got that call about the CAT scan, I was like, they're right. I don't have to go to his office. I can literally go to another floor in the same building, and it cost me a heck of a lot less.
But you were lucky that that protocol was in place, that you got that call in the first place.
That's right. I mean, I was just having a conversation at lunch. This probably doesn't sound like the best luncheon conversation, but with some other folks about healthcare, and they were talking about this phenomenon that some of your listeners may have had. I've experienced it where you go in, and you're in a hospital, it's in your network, and you find out your anesthesiologist isn't in network. Or your pathologist, if you had a biopsy or something, isn't in the network, and how that creates problems for patients that may or may not know that's even happening to them.
Mm. Well,
so it's, tough.
Thank you, Dan, for your call. Let's now go to Patricia in Madison. Hi, Patricia.
Thank you for taking my call. You not really criticized, but talked about the Republicans trying to hasten this bill through or these revisions. And I guess we can never forget Nancy Pelosi saying, let's get this bill passed so we can see what's in it.
Yeah, I don't know why she ever said that, because we could all read it before it ran. I never really got that.
And I have a question, too. Did not President Obama meet with pharmaceutical companies before the bill ever was passed that would have prohibited the users from obtaining, drugs from Canada at a cheaper cost?
Well, let me answer that in a different way. There's a couple of things. If you go back to the summer of 2009, right, when it was very clear the president and Democrats on Capitol Hill, because they control both chambers, were going to pursue the Affordable Care Act, right? You had insurers come to the White House, drug makers come to the White House, hospitals came to the White House, because those industries knew they were going to pass something, and they wanted to make sure that they shaped it to the extent that they could, okay? So that's one part of that question. He met with everybody. Because he wanted everyone to talk about this particular idea of overhauling the healthcare system and the Affordable Care Act to get their intake. So I just want to go over the second part of your question again about drug prices.
Yeah, go ahead.
Are you still there?
Patricia, yes.
Is Patricia still there? Yeah, sorry about that. I just want to understand the second part of that question.
Patricia, are you still there? Oh, no, she's not. She's dropped off.
That's okay. I think she's talking about this bigger issue of re-importing drugs from other countries where they may be cheaper.
Like Canada.
Whether it's Canada is a classic example, right? But that has been – it's a really interesting topic because it has gotten – there's people in both parties that like it, and there are people that in both parties that hate it. All sorts of issues come up about safety, about fair trade, fair market, consumer issues, all kinds of things. And you're going to see more legislative action on the Hill about it. There's more. I want to say it's John McCain, Senator McCain from Arizona, isn't reintroducing a drug reimportation bill. This hasn't gone away, but I remember covering that, probably in the early 2000s on Capitol Hill, the big fight over it, and watching Democrats, who I thought would be all for it, get up on the floor of the House and say, you know, this isn't safe. We can't monitor these drugs. Now, of course, monitoring is probably more sophisticated than it was, 13 years ago. But this continues to be one of these issues. But you have to remember that these other countries that are setting prices for drugs, if the manufacturers see a lot of those drugs coming into the United States, I think what they'll do is go to the drug minister of Canada or whatever country and simply say, well, we give you this much of this drug. We know it's mostly going to the United States now through drug reimportation, so we're just going to go ahead and cut your supply. There's nothing requiring them to provide certain amounts of drugs at certain prices. So that's kind of another interesting twist on that issue.
Well, let's squeeze in one more call here. Ben in Appleton. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
What would you like to add?
Question about the Cadillac plan tax. I have a tough time understanding why these bills want to tax a healthcare plan that people have that is really actually very, very good in order to able to afford these other things. Why don't they tax something like alcohol or soda or candy or cigarettes or something like that in order to pay for the healthcare bill?
Sure. What Ben's talking about is a tax on the highest cost, the most generous health insurance plans. It's in the Affordable Care Act. It was supposed to go into effect in 2018. It got pushed off to 2020 because unions and employers and other groups really oppose it. Economists love this because they say it can direct the consumer behavior and the employer behavior into more cost-effective plans if you slap a 40% excise tax on a plan that is, I think it was like 27 or 28 grand for a family plan. If it was above that, the excess above got hit with the excise tax, the 40%. Now, the Republican health plan pushes that off until 2025. It's a revenue raiser. It's something that economists on both ends of the spectrum love, because they think it will direct better consumer behavior and it raises money. But if you're someone who hasn't gotten a pay increase for maybe 5 years or so because your employer keeps telling you, well, I got to pay for your benefits with that money, you wouldn't be too thrilled about a Cadillac tax.
And as we wrap up here, Mary Agnes, what are the pressing questions you are asking and you want resolved here in the next days and weeks as we look at this legislation?
What's going to be the real-world impact of this House Republican plan? How many people are going to be covered? What kind of coverage are they going to receive, right? What are they going to have to pay out of their own pockets? How is this Medicaid per capita cap going to affect our most vulnerable, poorest individuals? What sort of state innovation do states want to do to try to get people covered? Has these ideas been road tested? How do they compare with the current Medicaid system? There are people that have a lot of complaints about the current Medicaid system. I'm not saying it's the only way to do it, but what are we talking about in these states? How would they use that flexibility? Who can they cover for that amount of money? What's that coverage going to look like? All those kinds of things, I think, are really interesting to find out.
And quickly, how can the public, what should we be watching here as we protect our own health care? How should we move forward in being well-versed in what's going on?
Well, if you're really interested in the current legislative debate, I would invite your listeners to come to our website. It's free. It's KHN for Kaiser Health News, khn.org. We provide a wonderful news aggregation product that has stories from publications all over the country, as well as our original content. But more importantly, almost, is in your own homes, and you're making your own decisions, make sure that you understand what your health care covers, how much it's going to cost you. Are your providers covered? Are they not? It's one of those things that people don't want to spend a lot of time on, but it can be incredibly important, because once the enrollment period's over, you're probably in that plan for a year. So you've got to know what it covers and what it costs you.
Mary Ignis, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us.
Thanks for having me.
Mary Ignis Carey is with Kaiser Health News. She's covered health reform and federal health policy for more than 15 years as an editor at CQ Healthbeat, as Capital Bureau Chief for Congressional Quarterly, and at Dow Jones Newswires. We can continue this conversation about the new healthcare replacement plan over on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow at this time, one of the intriguing offshoots of the swearing-in of Donald Trump was a spike in sales to the George Orwell classic 1984. Tomorrow, our conversation begins with Orwell Prize Chair Jean Seaton to see what she imagines Orwell's comments would be on the current administration. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this show, and we had on-air production help today from Colleen Duvall. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for a vacationing Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network.